Let's keep our Bibles open to that portion of the Old Testament, 2 Samuel chapter 11. And here, of course, we have the very familiar account of the great sin of David. Now, we are all aware that we can be so easily duped by what we see and what we're told. At times, when we see something on a screen, or when we hear something on a radio, we imagine one thing, only to, of course, discover it's quite another. This is true in advertising again and again. That well-positioned, that properly lit hamburger, that car on the screen looks so beautiful, so lush. That Photoshop picture looks far better on paper than what it does in reality. That's true in advertising, but it's especially true when it comes to temptation, my friends. Temptation has a way of so easily duping us. Temptation has a way of so easily deceiving us. Sin is deceitful again and again. And as we come to this portion of 2 Samuel in chapter 11 at verse 1, obviously, it is during the reign of King David. In fact, David, we could say, is at the peak of his reign. The Ammonites had hired Aramean armies to attack Israel. And if you look at the history of that time and place, you'll notice that eventually this resulted in a war, which then led to what we see here at the beginning of verse 1. The siege, a one-year-long siege, actually, of the city, the capital city of Rabbah, the capital of the Ammonites, Rabbah. It was this very city that David's general, Joab, successfully set out to conquer. And if you jump over to chapter 12 and verse 26, you see there him reporting that indeed he has captured the city. The city of Rabbah fell to David's armies, and the war ended with all of the Ammonite cities being conquered and plundered. Very little of the city in that date and time remains for us to see and to comprehend what the world was like. Later on in the times of Christ, the city was rebuilt, and it was renamed Philadelphia. We know of that city in the book of Revelation. Philadelphia was one of the 10 Greek-speaking Gentile cities on the east side of the Sea of Galilee. We often refer to the Decapolis, the 10 cities, Decapolis, 10 cities. The story here of David, in my opinion, adds to the credibility of the Word of God. It adds to our ability to comprehend how true the Word of God is. Besides the historical and archaeological accuracy of 2 Samuel chapter 11 and then chapter 12, this passage presents a very disappointing and astonishing story about King David. And in the words of one writer, it is disappointing because it shows how low David stoops. And it is astonishing because David is a key figure in the biblical account. And here he falls, and he falls hard. He falls low. Keep in mind that David is the man who is referred to as a man after God's own heart. And what we were just read to in chapter 11 does not describe a man who's following after the heart of God at all. So indeed, it is disappointing and it is astonishing. And I say this adds to the credibility of the Bible because this narrative is very candid. It is a frank account of Israel's hero and his very serious shortcomings, displaying, I believe, for us the truthfulness of the Bible. The Bible does not pick and choose stories that just simply make our heroes look good. But rather, the truthfulness of the Bible is that it speaks the whole truth. It tells us all that needs to be known. It does not gloss over the sins of men, even the heroic ones. And so the story begins with a scandal, and it ends with even a bigger scandal. In verses 2 through 5, you see that scandal. Well, it was just read to us, and I would imagine most of you, if not all, are familiar with the story from other times. The Bible here tells us that it was the end of the rainy season. The NIV plus says it was springtime. The truth is that there is no spring in Israel. From October to March, it's winter, and then April to September, it's summer. Rick would have a hard time in Israel. March is when the rain stops, and when the rain stops, the armies are more able to go out to battle without the threat of mud, without the threat of a flood or any inclement weather. And of course, because of the rainy season, there's even plenty of pasture for those battle animals, the horses in particular, to graze. March is named after the Roman god Mars, who happens to be the god of war. And so in March, the armies rallied. They rallied to attack. And of course, once they rally to attack, that means the other armies have to rally in order to defend. King David sends out his army. Enough of this sitting around and waiting. We've been waiting for good weather, and finally the rain has broken, and we are ready to go. And he sends out his army. But notice here that David decides to sit this one out. Verse 2 says, in an era where kings led their armies into battle, David, the warrior king, decides to stay home. He sends out his horses and his chariots. He sends out his infantry. He even sends out his mercenaries. Here in the English Standard Version, they're referred to as servants. They're mercenaries. He has thousands and thousands. He has at least 33,000 of these mercenaries. These are professional soldiers hired to serve, paid to serve in the army. In fact, if you go over to 2 Chronicles, you see that David actually paid the equivalent of $1,650,000 to each one of these guys. That's a lot of money. One flat fee. It wasn't per year. One flat fee. For as long as you can survive battle, it's yours. By the way, mercenaries today don't get paid so much. We still use them. They get paid anywhere from $90,000 to $250,000. Are you willing to go for that? Apparently some people are. Uriah the Hittite is a mercenary. And the contrast being set here is very clear. Do you see it? Every able-bodied warrior is gone out to battle, but David stays behind. While the armies are killing the enemy, David is killing time in his lush palace, about 50 miles from the battlefield. Keep in mind that Israel wanted a king. Do you remember why? 1 Samuel chapter 8. Israel wanted an army so that they could have, rather, they wanted a king so that they could have a leader who would go ahead of the troops in battle. Saul did that. David did that very much so as well up until this stage. Now he is an accomplished king. He is an accomplished warrior. And now he decides to stay home. Well, maybe he had an upset stomach. Maybe it was rheumatoid in his elbows. We don't know why he stayed home, but certainly he shouldn't have been. He had a job to do, but he stayed home. Take a look at the idleness of this warrior king. Your mother's adage that idle hands are the devil's workshop finds a lot of ground here in this passage. The text tells us that while he's casually walking along the roof of his palace in the cool of the evening or the end of the day, while he's walking along the roof of his palace, he glances downward. And he happens to see his neighbor cooling off as well. She's bathing. I assume she's bathing outdoors. I would hope there's a wall around her, and he's got a perspective that others do not have. The text does not tell us that. The text does not say that she's innocent. It simply puts all the blame on David because of what David chose to do. But I wonder how innocent she was. Verse 2 tells us that she's a beautiful woman. And we see that she's alone. And so is he. Her name is Bathsheba. It means daughter of seven. Can you imagine seven daughters in one house? That's a lot of hair all over the place, right? Isn't it? She's the daughter of Eliam, who's also a warrior in David's army. And she's the granddaughter of one of David's advisors. Apparently, she's from an elite family. And she's the wife of a Hittite man named Uriah. The nation of the Hittites was essentially unknown by archaeologists until recent history. In fact, critics of the Bible complained, saying there's no such thing. There was never any such thing as the Hittites. However, recent archaeology tells us that not only did the Hittites exist, but they were a vast and powerful nation that extended as far west as Turkey. In fact, Tarsus was a part of the Hittite Empire. But within about 100 years of what we see here in 2 Samuel 11, the Hittite nation culture began to collapse. And so there were great numbers of refugees, Hittite refugees, that had poured into Israel, and they made their lives there, some, many, converting to Judaism and becoming loyal to the God of the Bible, to the God of the Jews, to our God. The name Uriah meets Jehovah is my light. And if his name is any indication of his character, you see here that he is a man of godly devotion. You see that he is a man that sought to please God. So either he comes from a family that loved the Lord, or he's a man that loved the Lord so much that he developed this nickname that said he loves the Lord. Well, getting back to our tale here, to the account in the scriptures, David saw her and he wanted her for himself. And here David violates the 10th commandment. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife or his house or his property. Exodus chapter 20. David wasn't concerned with the 10 commandments, although he knew them very well. That's something that at this point he had set aside because it was something of greater interest. It's usually what happens, unfortunately, isn't it? It's usually what happens as we increase in our success. We tend to be less dependent of God. And we tend to not want to obey God. We begin to distance ourselves from God. And this is what's happening in David's life. Here's the odd thing. When things are going poorly, we run to God in prayer. Say, God bless us. And when he blesses us, what do? We slowly move away from God. And then we say, Lord, why are there problems in my life? Well, have you considered that maybe there's problems in your life because it's the only way by which God is going to keep you close to him? Could it be? David is at the peak of his reign. And he's not very interested in what the Ten Commandments have to say. Numbers chapter 15, verse 39 reads, remember all the commands of the Lord that you may obey them and not prostitute yourselves by chasing after the lusts of your own hearts and eyes. And David knew that. And he didn't care. And so the text tells us that he inquired and he found out who she was. He found out that she was a married woman. But here he has no regard for God's law. He has no regard for her husband. He has no regard for the law of the land. Keep in mind that the law of the land required the death penalty for adultery. Imagine if that was to be the case today. Woof. He had no regard for Bathsheba herself. And at verse 4, it says that he sent messengers and took her. Satisfying his arousal was much more important. Now, notice here, King David has everything, but apparently everything is not enough. Does that sound familiar to us? And so he steals the wife of a trusting and trusted servant. And David lies with her. And he breaks the seventh commandment. He commits adultery. And it was during the time of the month when she was most likely to become pregnant. It was the end of her cycle, which means that she was not already pregnant. The text here tells us at the end of verse 4 that she had purified herself from her uncleanliness, which is really a monthly ritual that every Jewish woman would have to perform. It was part of the ceremonial law. But notice here, she was willing to keep the ceremonial law, but at the same time, she was willing to betray her husband. This is the makings of legalism. The people would say, oh yes, I keep this rule, but when it comes to satisfying myself, I'll do as I please. It's the makings of legalism, and there's nothing new under the sun, is there? And so at verse 5, well, before we get to verse 5, look at what happens here. David sees, then he watches, he takes, and then he lies. That's the progression of temptation. Sees, watches, takes, lies. It's a similar thing that we see in the Garden of Eden with Eve. She saw, she watched, she took, she ate. Here David does likewise. Sees, watches, takes, lies. And that's when we read in verse 5. The only words recorded from the mouth of Bathsheba. 3 words. I am pregnant. While her husband's still at war, she is pregnant. These brief words will actually now set in motion the rest of David's life. They will be devastating. Let me point out for you 3 errors that David made. And these errors are sinful. So when I say error, please don't misunderstand me and suggest that they were just mistakes. No, these were sins. Sins. The first one is obvious. He refused to do what was required of him. He should have been out leading his troops, his nation. Proverbs chapter 15, verse 19 reads this way. The way of the sluggard is like a hedge of thorns, but the path of the upright is a level highway. David should have been fulfilling his responsibilities. Instead, he ignored them. Had he not ignored them, he would have not fallen into this particular temptation on this day. At the peak of his career, he allowed his pride to dictate his actions. Number 2, he actually was able to trick himself into believing that he can handle temptation. Now, we could think David is foolish, and he is, but then so are we, because we often think along the same lines, oh, I can handle this one. This one, I can handle. He took a second look. He figured he can deliberately ponder the subject of temptation and that he would be okay because, after all, I'm David. I got this one. I know what I'm doing. He figured that he can enjoy it briefly. After all, it's just his eyes and just his mind. He figured he's going to be okay. Which led to his third mistake, his third sin. He gave in to lust. Now notice here, the sin we're speaking of is obviously sexual sin. But the principles are true of any temptation. Whatever temptation you may face, the principles are the same. In this case here, it ended up in fulfilling his lustful desires. He had no regard for God or anybody else. He dove in, he seduced, and he demanded. And he was granted the desires of his heart. The desire of his heart was sinful, and his heart was filled to the full. In James chapter 1, verse 15, we're told this. Then desire, when it has conceived, gives birth to sin. And sin, when it is fully grown, brings forth death. You see, the devil doesn't have to make you do it. That was Flip Wilson. Remember him? The devil doesn't make us do it. That was what Tom Sawyer. The devil doesn't make us do it. It's our own hearts that make us do it. That was David. Well, the rest of the story records David's attempt to cover up his shameful, his out-of-control misuse of his authority, trying to cover up his sin against God. And we see here, beginning of verse 6, the scheme. It is a conniving cover-up. It's also a very dirty cover-up. And it leads to a very treacherous cover-up. The conniving cover-up begins at verse 6. It says that David sent word to Joab, send me Uriah the Hittite, and Joab sent Uriah to David. David calls Bathsheba's husband to the palace. He calls him home from the battlefield. And in verse 7, it reads, when Uriah came to him, David asked how Joab was doing, how the people were doing, how the war was going. Can you imagine Uriah's thoughts as he's standing before the king? What on earth am I doing here? David, the king, called me back for these trivial questions? The last thing Uriah would have expected is to be called back from a fierce battlefield to answer these trivial questions. It makes no sense to send a soldier home for this. And so after the small talk at verse 8, David said to Uriah, go down to your house and wash your feet. It's a way of saying, go enjoy your wife. David gives the man military leave. And David wants Uriah to go home and relax and spend the night in his own bed with his own wife, Bathsheba, figuring that in the next few weeks, she can send a messenger out to the battlefield and say, Uriah, guess what? We're pregnant. We're going to have a child. And Uriah will believe that he's the father. Well, Uriah leaves the palace. And if you look there, verse 8, the king is thinking that that Uriah is going to go home to his wife. And so the king sends a gift. I don't know what the gift was. Was it a fruit basket? Some lotions? It said, in compliments of the palace. I could just imagine Bathsheba's face when the knock came on the door and somebody gave her that basket. She's like, whoa, what is this? Who's this from? What's this about? Here's a surprise. This was indeed a conniving scheme, but it certainly is simple enough, would you agree? And I do believe that it would have worked had Uriah not been so loyal. Uriah did not go home. The scheme failed. And in verse 9 we read, but Uriah slept at the door of the king's house with all the servants of his lord, all the other mercenaries, and did not go down to his house. Uriah knew that it was wrong for him to go home to his wife. He was a warrior. In fact, he knew that there was, according to 1 Samuel 21, a conjugal ban instated on soldiers during wartime. And Uriah was true to his word. He had a responsibility that had been given to him. In fact, he had been paid handsomely to carry out this responsibility. He was going to be loyal to his nation. He was going to be loyal to his king. He was going to be loyal to the other troops. He was not willing to legitimately do, as per the king, what the king had illegitimately done to him. And so he went and he spent the night with the other mercenaries. So we go then to David's dirty cover-up. At verse 10, apparently it's the next day, says when they told David Uriah didn't go down to his house, David said to Uriah, haven't you come from a journey? In other words, haven't you come from this military campaign? why didn't you go down to your house? You see David's frustration, right? Do you see it? And there's a great difference here between David and Uriah. I hope you see it. I'm sure David saw it. There even seems to be a taunting of Uriah on David's part. And so at verse 11, Uriah responds, and look at what he says to the king. He says, "The ark and Israel and Judah dwell in booths." Now notice the first thing that comes out of his mouth is the ark. The ark, of course, is referring to the Ark of the Covenant. And it was the custom of the troops to take the ark into battle with them. Now the ark was probably around 40 miles away from the battle line. But the idea was is that you would take the presence of God with you into battle for victory. So the first thing that comes to mind is the presence of God. And then the people of Israel, the people of God. And he says, "And my lord Joab and the servants of my lord are camping in the open field. Shall I then go to my house and eat and drink and to lie with my wife?" And then he swears. He says, "As you live and as your soul lives, I will not do this thing." He appeals to the king's physical existence, and he appeals to the king's spiritual existence. And he says, "As surely as you live, my king, I will not do this." While all the others are serving and suffering and battling and dying, while all the others are defending your nation, your throne, I will not seek to please myself. Here we have a man of true honor. Would you agree? Which then takes us to verses 12 and 13. Then David said to Uriah, "Remain here today also, and tomorrow I will send you back." So Uriah remained in Jerusalem that day and the next. And David invited him, and he ate in the presence and drank, so that he made Uriah drunk. And in the evening he went out to lie on his couch. The couch is the bed. Went to lie on his couch with his servants, with the servants of the Lord. But he did not go down to his house. And notice here that David extends the leave of absence a little longer. And here Uriah is willing to do with the king what he was not willing to do in his own house. He sits down to eat, to enjoy himself. In fact, he eats and he drinks. David intentionally gets the man drunk, hoping that now he'll go down to his home and be with his wife. But he doesn't. A drunk Uriah is more loyal than a sober David. Isn't that amazing? Now, maybe he was so drunk he couldn't get down to his wife's house. I don't know. But he doesn't make it. Instead, verse 13 tells us that he goes and he spends the night with the other mercenaries again. And here we see the treacherous cover-up. David is out of ideas. And so he opts for one final, ruthless, treacherous solution. It is a cold-blooded scheme. At verses 14 and 15, we read, "In the morning, David wrote a letter to Joab," that's the general, "and sent it by the hand of Uriah. In the letter, David wrote, 'Set Uriah in the forefront of the hardest fighting, and then draw back from him that he may be struck down and die.'" Wow. David is desperate. The consequences of sin make a person desperate. They do. Here we have the man after God's own heart. He has willingly surrendered to sin. And now he is conspiring to murder. Listen, if there's a lesson for us to pull out of these verses, it's this. Any sin that you do not deal with will eventually cause you to spiral downward. Unresolved sin, unrepentant sin, unconfessed sin will cause you to spiral downward. It will unravel your life. Notice what happened here in David. Here's a sequence of events. First he's slothful, then he is lustful, then he is covetous, then he is adulterous. You see the downward spiral? Then he becomes abusive, then he is dishonoring, then he is deceitful, then he brings a man into drunkenness, then hypocrisy, and now murder. And it all started with that casual glance at the top of his home. And now Uriah is going to deliver his own death warrant. What shame. The Bible speaks to that as well, by the way. In Deuteronomy 27:24, it reads this way: cursed be anyone who strikes down his neighbor in secret. And David knew that. But it wasn't affecting David. He was determined. You see, his world had now collapsed. His inner man had become a void, empty, hollow shell. So General Joab, of course, he's besieging the city of Rabbah, which, by the way, involved surrounding the city and then cutting off every entrance and every exit. And, of course, cutting off any water source and any food source. And the idea was that by waiting it out, you would starve the city, and eventually they would raise the white flag and surrender. And in this way, there would be less casualties, and victory, obviously, is inevitable. As long as they had enough warriors who would wait it out, enough warriors that would stay away from the flying arrows. So General Joab receives the letter from Uriah. Can you imagine what's on his face? Uriah is saying, this is from the king. And Uriah opens the seal. He must have looked at Uriah and said, wow, if you only knew what you just gave me, man. And being the general that he was, he agrees. He agrees. At verse 15, it tells us that he sent the fighters, Uriah in particular, and others, to the fiercest place of the battle along the wall. And then retreated his men. And he was to leave, of course, Uriah exposed. At verse 16, it says, as Joab was besieging the city, he assigned Uriah the place where he knew there were valiant men, where he knew Uriah would not survive, where he knew these men would step out from behind a wall and shoot their arrows. He agrees to do it. And he commands other mercenaries to go as well. And of course, the archers come out and they shoot. Apparently, he had other men go because he wanted to keep David's plan a secret. It would have been too obvious had he called everybody back but left Uriah all there by himself. And so now there's other people dying as well. And at verse 17, we read, the men of the city came out and fought with Joab, and some of the servants of David among the people fell. And look, Uriah the Hittite also died. Now innocent men are dying. And of course, Uriah the loyal warrior dies too. That's because unresolved sin is like an octopus. It really is. An octopus whose tentacles just reach out beyond yourself. It wraps itself in the lives of others. That's right. Your sin will wrap itself around the lives of others. Your sin will strangle other people. My unconfessed sin will impact those around me. As you see here in the story, more and more people are being impacted at every stage by the sin of one man. And please do not think that these things are not true any longer. This is the world we live in, especially when we live within a community of church. Our sins are never left to ourselves. And so some people stop coming to church. Oh, my friends, what you need to do is stop sinning and keep coming to church. And so now David breaks the sixth commandment as well. You shall not murder. But David's not fazed. Take a look at the report and his response, beginning at verse 18. Joab makes clear to his messenger, after the Hittite is dead, he makes clear to his messenger what he expects for this man to go and explain, what he is to say to King David. And he gives the messenger a rather clandestine memo. And in this memo, it explains the battle, and it assures that David knows that the orders have been completed, that the orders have been carried out. Uriah is dead. And the messenger will now take this to the king, and he will have no idea of what it's really saying. But Joab is afraid that David is not going to fully comprehend. After all, others have died too. And so Joab tells the messenger, he says, look, tell David the bad news first. Tell him about his soldiers dying close to the city walls. And David is going to have a problem with this, with the strategy, because it's just foolishness to get so close to the wall. Obviously, you're going to lose life. But then, after you've told David this, give him the big news. Uriah is dead. I got the job done for you. Read with me at 22. The messenger went and came and told David all that Joab had sent him to tell. And the messenger said to David, the men gained, and I think he's embellishing it a little, but the men gained an advantage over us and came out against us in the field, but we drove them back to the entrance of the gate. Verse 24, then the archers shot at your servants from the wall. Some of the king's servants are dead, and your servant Uriah the Hittite is dead also. Now, with all that's been said already, I think this last portion is the most disturbing portion of the narrative, of the story. It is the testimony of the alarming effect that sin has on an individual's heart. This is true of men, it's true of women, it's true of children. The alarming effect that sin has on a person's heart. It is unexplainable, but it is the reality here in David's case. But it's also the reality in many people you go to school with and you go to work with. The same thing is true. But it's also the reality within our own lives. Take a look at how David responds to the death of Uriah. David is fully, completely, 100% self-absorbed. His only concern is for himself. His only concern is to keep his secret hidden. Look here, there's not going to be any sorrow demonstrated. Not for the soldiers that died, certainly not for Uriah, not even for Bathsheba, not especially any sorrow for his sin against God. This, of course, is the sin of arrogance. And the sin of arrogance comes when we become comfortable with other sins. When we become so comfortable with other sins, other things that we know we should not be doing, big and small, and we ignore them, eventually we fall prey to the sin of arrogance itself. Because sin will make you callous to sin. The more you sin, the more you're going to feel at home with sin. And the more you defend your sin, the more you will blame others for your sin. And the more you will dismiss your sin, there's not going to be any guilt. Have you been there where you know something is sinful, but it's just not sinful to you any longer? And you have to wonder, how did I get here? Look at verse 25. David takes a look at this messenger, and this is what he has to say to his general via this messenger. Do not let this matter displease you, for the sword devours now one and now another. Strengthen your attack against the city and overthrow it. Look at the heart of David. He has this casual, blasé attitude, and he says, these things happen. That's what war is all about. Regroup, press on, and win this battle. That's what he's become. He's unaffected by his own sin. And the story ends here. I should say the chapter ends, because the story continues. The chapter ends with verses 26 and 27, where you see the consequences. The consequences are severe. In verse 26, Bathsheba's mourning. We know that's a seven-day period. That was the tradition, that was the law, that you mourn for 7 days. During these days, she comes to the understanding that she is now a widow. She is pained by the guilt of her infidelity. She is alone. She is no longer in the arms of the man that loved her. She is pregnant. She is alone, and she's shamed. Now, I know that in today's world, that's not so shameful. It should be. But back then, it was especially shameful. In verse 27, it says that David takes her to be his next wife. Emphasis on next. Literally, it reads, he sent for her and collected her. Wow. Emphasis on, once again, the abuse of the royal power. David just becomes this unrecognizable man who claims God as his Lord. He's a completely different man. A man of faith and uprightness who has now stooped to the lowest levels, and he's able to persuade himself that he's okay. Isn't that frightening? Does that scare you like it does me? That a man that can be so close to God could actually persuade himself that he's okay, even though he's doing everything contrary to the word of God, and it is severe. But listen, only because we may not act so severely doesn't mean that it's okay when we do it. Now, if you go over to chapter 12, you see that the child is born in due course. But within 7 days, chapter 12, verse 16, the baby dies. He did not live long enough to even be named. And here, David's life goes into a tailspin. And the rest of his life, the rest of his reign, in fact, his entire family is adversely impacted by what started here as a lustful glance at a beautiful woman bathing. But most of all, my friends, verse 27 tells us that God was displeased. I do find it interesting that God did not act, God did not intervene, God did not assert himself in all this. He could have, correct? As you're reading it, aren't you hoping that God will jump in somewhere? Now God would be good, but he doesn't. In the words of one writer, God is simply there. He's simply there. There is a causal relationship here, my friends. We live in a world of causal relationships. In other words, there is a cause and effect, a cause and effect. God has made rules of nature, laws of nature, cause and effect. So if we do this, this is what's going to happen. And God often allows those to run the course. When he does it, we call that a miracle. But normally, God allows the cause and effect, laws of nature, to live in our lives. And here, this is exactly what God is doing. But when he does act, and he does, read on, next chapter, he meets sin with justice. His wrath is mediated only by his grace and his mercy and his purpose. And here, my friends, we see the extraordinary God, that in all this, he would respond with grace and mercy according to his purpose. That's how extraordinary our God is. Till finally, David confesses and repents. That's Psalm 51 that Bob read to us earlier. But this is only after a great deal of pain, a great deal of grief. After so many lives were shattered because of this one man's choices. But God does restore David. God does take this repentant man and restores him. But the consequences are still there. They still are lived out. Well, my friends, in closing, let me just remind you to keep in mind that sin is always an inside job. It does not come from the outside in. It comes from the inside out. Our heart lives in a constant battle between what is righteous and our propensity for what is evil. So never say, oh, no, no, not me. Oh, no, that's beyond me. Oh, no, I'm beyond that. Keep in mind that the heart is often wicked and how dangerous it is to be in the grips of temptation. flee youthful lusts. The problem with youthful lusts is that when you grow old, the lusts remain. Run from them. Run.